May I have your attention? My name is Tom Kimball. I'm the marketing director for Signature Books. I got roped into this. I'd like to introduce you to a couple of people. First, you're going to hear from George Smith. George is the author of Nauvoo Polygamy. Shameless plug, I'm the marketing director. I've got them for sale out here. So come and grab one from me, okay? I don't want to take them home. You know, you can never have enough books in your luggage. Okay?
Tell me you're responsible for the title.
Yeah. I am responsible for the title. Later on, I wish I'd done something like Sex in the City of God, but we're running with this one for right now. George is also the author of several other books, including books on feminism. William Clayton, who was Joseph Smith's journal keeper, also my great-grandfather's journal keeper, Heber Kimball. He's also known for his works on B.H. Roberts, and you've done some work on Blacks in the Free States, is that right?
Oh, various things, articles.
George has five kids. He has five grandkids. Two of his children are still in medical school. I thought they'd wrap that up.
Well, they're still wrapping.
Yeah, I know how that goes. He met his wife, Camilla, in Central Park. Is that right, Camilla?
In which city?
In Central Park in Florida. Is that right? No, just kidding. New York. George went to, what was the name of the elementary school?
Public school number 8.
Public school number 8. Only in New York do they number them. Yeah. At least it wasn't Steve Garvey Elementary School or something like that, right? It'd be Reggie Jackson, I'm sorry. George is also a graduate from Stanford and New York.
NYU.
Right. And George has been affiliated with Signature Books since 1981. And more importantly, George is important. We owe a great deal in Mormon studies to George Smith. And I'm very fortunate to be able to call him my friend. Afterwards, we're going to hear from a response by Todd Compton. Todd has a PhD in classics from UCLA. He's the author of In Sacred Loneliness, Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, which gives a short biography of each of the plural wives of Joseph Smith, and I have one copy out there. He's also a musician and a father of two young, rowdy, towhead boys that you see running around. Anyway, I turn the time over to George. Thank you.
I should say that Tom is a descendant of Heber C. Kimball from his first wife, Valet. So he's royalty in our mix. And he doesn't let me forget that. The subject appears to be celestial marriage and how it devolved into big love. It's kind of a complicated subject. It could go a lot of directions. It could go very old. Essentially, it began in Nauvoo, Illinois, along the Mississippi River, the east bank of the river from the years 1840 to 1846. It flourished there in silence. The marriages were unannounced. It was illegal at that time, and perhaps today, in the state of Illinois. It was denied as rumors, anti-Mormon rumors maybe. It eventually, as you can imagine, something like plural wives and became more and more known, and there was a revolt within Nauvoo, which led to various very difficult circumstances, the destruction of a newspaper, Joseph Smith's arrest and assassination, and ultimately the expulsion of the Mormon people from the country, not just Illinois, but into Mexico, prior to the westward expansion of the United States. It was in 1852, 6 years later, that polygamy was announced from Salt Lake. There was a sort of a small announcement in 1851, but the official one was 52. And here we're out in, we're safe. we practice this, but during that window of time, the history was never rewritten. The history of the church was based upon Joseph Smith's journals, diaries, and he knew those were going to be read. These were unannounced marriages. He left out entirely his plural wives and those of his associates. There's very little of direct official diary material or from what was used to make form the history of the church to tell us about Nauvoo polygamy. At when we got to the period of time, 1890, 1904, we had a couple of manifestos under government pressure. Polygamy by the main church was abandoned, and then, as you can imagine, forgotten. It's not in the history. It's very uncomfortable. Everybody wanted to forget it. There were a few, what we now call fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, who continued the practice, and they number something close to 40,000 today, and we read about them, of course, in rather difficult circumstances. Reluctant 12-year-old brides in Texas communes, and it's a struggle, and of course the main LDS church in Utah doesn't want to be associated with that sort of struggle, and it's something past. And so we really do have a forgotten history. Now the teaching manuals, which for men and women, show these polygamy pioneers as having one wife. This is Joseph Smith. This is Brigham Young. They don't say there are no other wives. They just don't show a wife besides the first one. So it's sort of a forgetting reinforced by teaching processes that unless these aspects of history are rediscovered, they really are kind of on the way down. Now, they began to be rediscovered in the mid, 1930s. Stan Ivins went into archives and had a whole list of wives. Some of them are really, really wives that we could find documentation for, and some not. But he just pulled them all out and said, let's talk about this. And then you have Dale Morgan, Fawn Brody, later on Don L. Bachman, Larry Foster, Todd Compton, Garrett Rivera, quite a number of people, I'm skipping around in time, that did a lot of research and helped bring this out. So we have a non-history officially, and we have a kind of an uncertain emerging Samizdat history, possibly, that various people are pulling together. And the only reason I got involved in this, I think I asked, maybe I was talking to Michael Quinn, and I said, how many wives are there in some respect? And he named a couple or a few, and it was uncertain. And we're talking about wives of Joseph Smith, but we were not talking about wives of the other 200 men in Nauvoo that married plural wives. We had a total of 200 men and nearly 700 women. And those Nauvoo families went west to form the blueprint for Mormon polygamy throughout the American West. And that those families took more wives. It became over 1,100 women to that 200 Nauvoo families, about 5.5 wives to family on average. And those averages keep changing as the time goes on. That's another interesting story, the whole numbers aspect, but it's a little dull to talk about numbers. I just mentioned that at the outset. So maybe what we're trying to do here is talk about where did big love or plural marriage come from? In the concept of celestial marriage, the origins are fairly understandable. There was a lot of interest in the late 1700s, early 1800s in planetary astronomy. You go back to Copernicus with putting the sun kind of in the middle of all these planetary movements, but things weren't too accurate. Then you had Galileo with telescopes and doing some measuring, And then you had the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe and his assistant Kepler, Johannes Kepler, I believe, and they did some really good measurement. And they measured very close and found where these planets were going, but they had no idea why. Just, you know, it's confusing. The things they wrote confused people for decades because they didn't know how this could possibly happen. It took Newton coming later to say, okay, here's forces of motion, gravity, here's how it works. And at that point, we sort of discovered planetary astronomy. And by the time Joseph Smith had formed his church, the Church of Christ, as he first called it, in 1830, there were a lot of people talking about what goes on these celestial spheres. Could people ever get up there? And that became kind of an interesting subject. I'll just read a little bit relation to that. There was a writer in those early days named Thomas Dick, who talked about the soul that took its ethereal flight into a, quote, celestial region, puts on immortality. And Smith's celestial marriage, of course, was designated for individuals in a perfectionist religion who became perfect, as was described. And a man would be given a planet. He would have several wives, a number of wives, and raise infinite children, taking language from the Hebrew writings. Multiply, more than the sands of the sea and the stars in the sky. So you have this celestial marriage partly related to the time. Now, there were other kingdoms besides celestial, which we would say is heaven-like. There's terrestrial, which is earth-like, and telestial was an 18th century term, teleology, meaning study of design in nature. And Thomas Dick went on to say, if room were wanted for new creations, 10,000 additional worlds could be comprised within the limits of the solar system. Immeasurable spaces between our planetary system. And he's talking about revolutions of millions of worlds. Now, there was another writer who used those very similar terms, and that's Emanuel Swedenborg. And he talked about a pre-existent life, eternal marriage for couples who had a true affinity for each other, certain couples only. And a three-tiered heaven, which sounds a little bit like the three-tiered heaven that Joseph Smith mentioned. Not entirely the same, but those ideas were floating around. Swedenborg also used the term celestial spouses, which, as he went on, would have great pleasure at various levels. And anyway, those ideas were current at that time of year. So in a sense, where does celestial come from? In part, it does come from the planetary astronomy. It also comes from the Hebrew writings, which do offer the example of multiple families, and also the words, and I won't start to quote them because they're vast, multiply and replenish, expand the families, you'll be as numerous as the sands of the seashore, the stars in the skies. We find those metaphors in Mormon literature. So it's really locked into astronomy and Hebrew culture. There were antecedents in European discussions about marriage. There was a concern, what is marriage? Is it civil law? Is it Roman Catholic canon law? Is it guided by natural law? And there were arguments and debates, and women and plural marriage were issues that were used to develop those ideas. What kinds of laws do we go by, and how strong are these various churches politically? The Holy Roman Catholic Church, the Protestant Revolution, kind of resisting papal authority, and you have Philip of Hesse in Germany and Henry VIII, of course, in England, part of this revolution and also part of this discussion on marriage. And at one point, this German industrialist, the newly formed Germany, is asking for a second wife. This is Philip of Hesse, and he's got a lovely wife, and she's brought him all kinds of children, but you know, it's just not enough. He's a king in his world, and he wants more. And so he goes to the church authorities, and he says, "I really need another wife. And here's this lovely young woman, and it's time, and I'm ready. And can't you allow me to do this legally?" And so they struggle with this, and they issue in 1539 a confessional Eichtrott, kind of advice, permission. And they say these words, which are kind of interesting. They say, "As your princely grace has indicated to us through Dr. Bucer, this is our thought. Now, we cannot advise that any should make a public introduction, that is a law, that it is allowable to marry more than one wife. Your princely grace could perceive that such a public announcement would take this for common law, and from which great scandal and trouble would result." And then they lectured him a little bit. "God has instituted marriage as a society between two persons alone." And they go back to the Hebrew writings, Lamech, who's the sixth generation from Cain, actually, coming down from Adam, introduced the example of having more than one wife. Abraham and his descendants took more wives, so it became to be allowed in the law of Moses. But inasmuch as at the beginning of the creation, man was not to have more than one wife, it's not going to work generally. So then they say, "Well, you're pretty powerful still, and you give a lot of money to the church, and so caution is to be used, that this affair is not brought into the world publicly as a law which others might follow. And although there is no law, but a dispensation, which we're giving you, your princely grace must think of the scandal, namely your enemies of the gospel will cry out that we are like heathens," and so forth. And then they conclude, "So far we hold this for the right, that what is permitted concerning marriage in the law of Moses is not forbidden by the gospel." So in this Eichtrott in the mid-1500s, they've opened the door a crack. And people argued about this in different cultures in Europe. And John Milton in England, whom we know as giving flesh to the Adam and Eve account, as his writings were spoken from the pulpit, he apparently got involved in the issue of plural marriage, and there was something of his that was not published then, but printed in 1825 and reviewed in America. Well, now this enables us to change tracks kind of closely, because 1825 is the year that Joseph Smith met his wife-to-be, Emma Hale. He was doing some work down in Pennsylvania with his father. They stayed at the home of the Hales, and he eloped with her 2 years later, 1827. The year that Joseph eloped with Emma is the year that he gave a record of picking up the plates from the ground and began dictating translation of the plates. Well, that's 1827. In 1830, the Book of Mormon was published, and this is the first case in Latter-day Saint history where the issue of plural marriage is mentioned. It's in the Book of Mormon, not as a right to go and practice plural marriage, but as a prohibition, a conditional prohibition. The words are, you shall not do this, and they're talking about the ancient Hebrews. You know, this is terrible, this is like concubinage. And then at the end of this, there's a statement that says, well, if I, this is the deity being cited by the speaker, if I decide to raise seed, righteous seed, then I will tell my prophet, and only under those conditions might we ever even talk about this. Well, this is 1830. People are able to read this. Sometime between 1831 and 1841, the Latter-day Saints, in fact, are practicing plural marriage. The assumption is that the deity who was forbidding this conditionally had found those conditions met, had spoken to a representative, and he had passed it on to the people. Now, whether that's in 1831 during the Lamanite mission in Ohio, western areas, or whether it was in 1841, which I think is the first really solid evidence of a marriage, a plural marriage, Joseph Smith to Louisa Beeman. During those years in the 30s, Joseph was to meet many of the 30 to 40 women that he married, and some of them were 5, 6, 7 years old, and he waited, you know, 10 years later, they're 15, 16, 17, and older. And the range of age when he married his plural wives was from 14 being the youngest to, I guess it's about 58 being the oldest. So it was kind of a broad range. But the meeting of these various, you know, I think, how does a man meet and convince that many women to agree to marriage? I think most of us have a lot of trouble finding one. I mean, it's really a difficult task. I think most everybody would say that. But he was, you have to say he's a very unusual person, and to forget everything else to be able to talk 30 to 40 women into marital relationships, I think that's a remarkable accolade. Now, whatever else you want to say. Nauvoo polygamy, celestial marriage, has several roots, some of them ancient, some of them coincident with the formation of the LDS Church. And I don't have a lot of time, but I think just for a few minutes, I'd like to put some of these events, as we'd say, in their own words. I would like to describe how Big Love began, as it began. And it essentially was 1840. Joseph Smith's father died, a big change in his life. He's without his father. His apostles are away on missions, mostly in England. John Bennett comes to Nauvoo and joins the Mormon community, is brought into the church, made mayor of the town, lives in Joseph's and Emma's house for several months. A lot of social changes are going on. And he also talks to Joseph Noble, who's a good friend of his, and says, basically, I would like to marry your wife's sister, Louisa Beeman. Noble was married to a Beeman. There were three Beeman daughters. And actually, the Smiths knew the Beeman family, so he might have known the Beemans as early as he knew Emma, for all we know, a long time. So this is all set in 1840. That's where the groundwork was set, besides meeting all of the women over the last 10 years. And in 1841, Joseph marries Louisa Beeman by virtue of Joseph Noble going with them down by the river or in view of the river, saying words that Joseph tells him to speak. And one account shows her wearing a man's hat and coat, maybe as a disguise to not make it obvious they're doing something unusual. But there is this, what seems to be a landmark marriage on April the 5th, 1841. And in this Genesis year, he also marries two Huntington sisters, Zina and Presendia Huntington. They're both married already. Zina is pregnant with a child. This is a little unusual, and people have trouble thinking about this, but this is what happened. He married Zina October 27th and Presendia December the 11th. Altogether, to the best of my counting, Joseph married 19 single women, 14 married women, and 5 widows. Now, you know, one can be right and wrong. I could have missed some. Maybe somebody is disqualified, but that's the approximate proportion of his wives, which looked like to me about 38. There's a comment of Joseph Noble on the marriage to Louisa Beeman that I don't know if you have this book that Tom mentioned, Nauvoo Polygamy, but we called it Celestial Marriage. But on page 61, Joseph Noble offered testimony in the Temple Lot hearings. This is a dispute over land in Missouri. Who owns the land? And they got into plural marriage because which of the churches looked like they were the natural consequence of the early church would be maybe the most reasonable group to assume that property in Missouri. So they have this lawsuit, and this goes on from 1892. So Joseph Noble's testimony emphasized that this precedent-setting plural marriage was more than a union in spirit. In his deposition, he said he performed the marriage ceremony, giving him my wife's sister, or Louisa Beeman, to the prophet, at a rented house in Nauvoo. Asked whether there was a honeymoon, he said, "I know it, for I saw him in bed with her." Now, this is a presumptuous thing to say, but he says this, adding that right straight across the river from Iowa at my house, they slept together. Noble gave the prophet some counsel to, quote, "blow out the lights and get into bed and you will be safer there." Smith took my advice, in quotes, he continued, and then the court reporters say, and Noble laughed heartily. According to the court reporter, Noble said the newlyweds got into bed soon after the ceremony, between around 6 and 8 in the evening. As Noble left the house, Noble recalled that he knew they spent the night because Joseph later told me he did. So, was he a witness? Probably not. He probably heard it later, but he's speaking assertively, and he's a colorful guy, and that's what you hear, and so take it with a grain of salt. But he is an eyewitness of 11 that I've tried to collect for this first rather significant plural marriage. The comments about Zina Huntington come very soon. That year, she began an autobiography in September of 1840 that recalled her first meeting with the prophet when she and her family arrived in Kirtland. And this is kind of valuable. I think Todd got into this at one point. It's a wonderful statement. She says, "I saw the prophet's face for the first time. He was 6 feet, light auburn hair and a heavy nose, blue eyes, the eyeballs full and round, rather long forehead, and when he was filled with the spirit of revelation or inspiration to talk to the saints, his countenance would look clear and bright." So what happens is her mother died in 1839. Her father suffered financial losses, and she was invited into the Smith household to stay. Joseph asked her for her hand in marriage. He pressed her for an answer, at least on 3 occasions in 1840. And there was a kind of a struggle. She avoided answering him. She was uncomfortable. Within a few months, Joseph insisted the Lord had made known to him that she, Zina, was to be his celestial wife. Then the couple, husband as wife, were apparently willing. So on October 27, she was 6 months pregnant, and she became the first Mormon woman to accept a polyandrous union, which was kind of a significant step for her. She was not necessarily happy about that, but that's what happened. And her diaries are very interesting. Joseph, the next year, in 1842, did something rather unusual. He started inviting men to marry plural wives. And four men married plural wives in 42, a lot more in 43. And then you had husbands and wives, or men and women, being part of plural marriage. One of the interesting comments is that of the marriage to Agnes Coolbrith. And I'm not entirely sure, Todd, is this something that you have, did you discover this? Who's the person who discovered Agnes? I know it wasn't known, but I thought you had something to do with it.
I don't think I discovered it.
Okay. But it was on January the 3rd, 1842, he married his fourth plural wife. She was the widow of his younger brother, Don Carlos. Her daughter, Josephine, was named in honor of Joseph, but she went by Ina, and both Ina and Agnes avoided being known as related to Joseph Smith. What's interesting is Brigham Young recorded the date of this Leverett-like marriage in his diary. Now here we learn something about Brigham. You might have heard this before, but in coded language, he wrote that on January the 6th, 1842, I was taken into the lodge. Joseph Smith was, which means W-A-S, wed and sealed, Agnes. There is no mention of the event in the history of the church on that day. His clerk, Willard Richards, wrote for him that truly this is a day long to be remembered, a day in which heaven has begun to restore the ancient order of his kingdom, the restitution of all things. So there's suggestions you could imagine, an oblique reference to plural marriage. Then there's additional confirmation from John Bennett, who wrote also in coded letters, and this goes on. Well, I am going to have to quit here because we're running out of time. But I think if I would like to read one more reference to learning about plural marriage, and this is kind of a normal reference. This is Joseph Kelty. Joseph Andrew Kelting was from Philadelphia. He was a deputy sheriff of Hancock County, Illinois, and a lawyer for LDS Bishop George Miller. And in 1894, this is what he testified. For some time previous to the death of Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, I lived at Nauvoo. I heard rumors to the effect that Joseph Smith was practicing polygamy, the matter frequently being repeated by William and Wilson Law and the Higbees. Calling at the house of the prophet one day, early in the spring of 44, on some business, the prophet invited me into a room upstairs in his house, called the mansion. After we entered the room, he locked the door and then asked me if I had heard the rumors connecting him with polygamy. I told him I had. He then began a defense of the doctrine by referring to the Old Testament. I told him I did not want to hear that, as I could read it for myself. He claimed to be a prophet. I believed him to be a prophet, and I wanted to know what he had to say about it. He expressed some doubts as to how I might receive it, and wanted to know if I would be ready, if he'd be ready to believe. I then pledged that any word, whether I believed it or not, I would not betray him. Then he informed me that he had received a revelation which taught the correctness of the doctrine of plurality of wives and commanded him to obey it. He acknowledged to having married several wives. I told him that was all right. He said he would like a further pledge that I would not betray him. I asked him if he wanted me to accept the principle myself, marrying a plural wife. He said yes. A short time after this, I married two wives in that order of marriage. And he doesn't argue. He doesn't. He goes along. He becomes part of it. It's like the symbol, but I won't betray you. I'm going to do it myself. There are dozens of stories which are sometimes subtle, sometimes extraordinary, but they fill the chapters of journals and diaries, affidavits, and court depositions. So I think we are through with the this part of the presentation, and I guess Todd Compton, are you going to respond? Thank you very much.
With your plates, there's some bins, gray bins just outside. You put your plates right in the bins, and they'll take care of them there. Okay.
George's book has a lot of facets, and I thought I'd comment on one facet just at the beginning here. So I had a couple of interesting experiences relating to it as I started to research my book. And one of the facets is, he talks about how Joseph Smith's polygamy became like a secret history. Sometimes you could refer to it, some aspects of it, but you didn't talk about the details. And when I was researching in Sacred Loneliness, I remember there was one person who had written a BYU master's thesis on Joseph Smith. And I won't use any names here, but and I knew he was interested in Joseph Smith's polygamy because he'd written a couple papers on it, student papers. And so I called him up out of the blue one time, and I had some questions. And he said, "Why are you asking me these questions?" I said, "Well, I'm writing a book on Joseph Smith's plural wives." He said, "Who gave you permission to write?" And I said, "Oh, well, no one." You know, and then the conversation, it went, he was very cold, you know, and so we ended the conversation. And I found out later that he had wanted to do his master's thesis on Joseph Smith's polygamy, and the people at BYU had not allowed him to do that. And, you know, it was just a subject you were not supposed to deal with. And so I think he was a little resentful of me, just, you know, no authority at all, just taking out the subject. Another story, one person who was at BYU, again, wanted to write on Joseph Smith's polygamy. And so he went to the people who would be in charge of guiding him, and they said, oh no, we're sorry, you can't write on Joseph Smith's polygamy. He said, there's two subjects you can't write about, you can't deal with, you know, and one is polygamy, and the other is blacks in the priesthood. He said, sorry. And so this person actually went to a non-Mormon university, did his master's thesis on Joseph Smith's polygamy. His director was a non-Mormon. And there's a great irony there, you know, but it really shows what one of the aspects of this book that George has emphasized. The story of Joseph Smith and his polygamy kind of became a taboo subject. And so hopefully it'll become less taboo through my book and through George's book. Okay, generally, George Smith's Nauvoo polygamy, but we called it celestial marriage, is an extremely important contribution to the history of polygamy and to Mormon history. Carefully written, the result of exhaustive research, it provides many significant insights into the beginnings of Mormon polygamy. And it's been compared to my book, but it's quite different in a lot of ways. I looked at Joseph Smith's polygamy from the standpoint of his 33 plural wives, and I consciously didn't look very much beyond that. And he broadens the focus and looks at from the viewpoint of Joseph Smith at many times, and he looks at it from the viewpoint of the context of what was happening to Joseph Smith. And a lot of that just simply isn't in my book. It wasn't in my focus. And so a lot of that is very enlightening. So he follows Vaughn Brody, Donahill, Richard Bushman, in looking at the earliest Mormon polygamy from the standpoint of viewpoint of Joseph Smith. Okay, but let's compare his treatment of it with Richard Bushman's treatment. And I have a lot of respect for Richard Bushman and for his book. And I think what he wrote about polygamy, Joseph Smith's polygamy, was very, very difficult for a lot of conservative Mormons to deal with. So it's kind of a landmark. But I counted the number of pages about Joseph Smith's polygamy in his book, and I came up with 18. Okay, so if you want to know about Joseph Smith and his polygamy, you get a lot more data on it in George Smith's, and I count 200 pages on that, so George Smith's book. And I think Bushman simply wasn't that interested in Joseph Smith's polygamy. Okay, so if you are interested in Joseph Smith's polygamy, you're much better off, you know, read what Bushman has to say, but then go to Nauvoo polygamy. Okay, another way in which, another great contribution of this book is he looks at beyond Joseph Smith to the polygamists who followed Joseph Smith in Nauvoo. And it's a very important and fascinating story to see how polygamy broadened from, and how the different early church leaders dealt with it as it came to them. And there is the misapprehension that there wasn't much polygamy in Nauvoo until you got to Utah, but this book really sets that myth to rest. That there, you know, what I call practical polygamy began in late Nauvoo. It didn't begin just in Utah. And I think one of the important, interesting aspects of this book, as I read through it, is it showed me how important Brigham Young was. And as leading apostle of the church, he began to set up his plural households and openly provide for his plural wives. So I think, as in so many other areas, Brigham Young continued what Joseph did and raised it to another level. And depending on how you look at polygamy, that may seem bad or good to you, but Young's historical impact and influence are undeniable. And I think that comes through in George's book. I was going to mention one other little thing that really struck me on reading his book, from the viewpoint of Joseph Smith, was how busy Joseph Smith was. George shows the other things that were going on in his life, in addition to polygamy, and he was just juggling an incredible amount of balls. I mean, you know, the secular military leadership of Nauvoo, sacred leadership of the people, evading legal harassment, dealing with his first family. There were a lot of things going on in his life. And still, despite all of this, he constantly took time to court and marry plural wives, sometimes two or three in a month. In May 1843, he married four plural wives. So I think that shows how really important polygamy was to him. There's also a magnificent appendix of Nauvoo polygamists in this book. And already I've started using it in my own work. And even in the paper this morning, as you know, I told a little story about Charles Rich, which I got from this book. And I think just that appendix will really be a wonderful contribution to Mormon scholarship. No book is perfect, and this book has limitations. George has had the astounding audacity to disagree with me on a couple of issues. Notably, I account Fanny Alger, a plural wife of Joseph Smith, based on the autobiography of Alger's cousin, Mosiah Hancock. So I include the formal beginnings of polygamy in 1833. Also, in the case of Helen Mark Kimball, Joseph's youngest wife, I believe there is no evidence pro or con for her having physical relations with Joseph Smith. And given no evidence either way, I believe that based on marriage patterns in Utah, Helen Mark probably did not have relations with Joseph. George portrays the marriage of Helen Moore and Joseph Smith as including physical relations. So you can look at his argumentation and see what you think. As in any major detailed work of scholarship, many details and interpretations in this book will be debated and perhaps modified in the future, but I don't believe any fair-minded reader would deny the enormous contribution this book has made to our understanding of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and Nauvoo Quilty. Thanks.